This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is Travels with George, In Search of Washington and His Legacy. As Washington and his entourage, Prescott, his Tobias Lear is with him, his secretary. Others are with him traveling to Boston. But what's important now is how Washington presents himself to the people and the governors. And John Hancock is the governor of Massachusetts, probably the richest man in North America. Hancock will test who's more important, the governor of Massachusetts or the president of the United States. And at this point, Nat, I got the sense that Washington is playing a double game. He's also he's being commonplace with everybody he meets, but at the same time, he's aware of the fact that there are personages who think they're more important than he is. Is that how to read it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think what we take for granted today, that a president outranks a governor, but that wasn't necessarily the case in 1789. Before the Constitution, the governors were the ones with the primary political power. They were the most influential and powerful political figures. And but with the Constitution, there was the invention of the presidency. And I think there are some personal factors as well. John Hancock had invited Washington to stay with him in Hancock's mansion on Beacon Hill. And because Washington had committed himself to staying only in public taverns, he had to decline the offer. And somewhat miffed, Hancock had invited Washington to dinner. And Washington said, well, good, I'll come to dinner. That'd be fine. And yet, when Washington arrives in Boston, you know, this it's a huge crowd that's come out to meet him. Hancock is a no-show. Washington takes note of this. He's told that Hancock is back home suffering from gout on a painful couch and can't make it. But Washington is not entirely convinced. Washington returns to his public gathering, his public quarters, is due for dinner at Hancock's, but sends Hancock a letter saying, since you were not able to see me today, I will not be the first to come to your door. So I am not coming to dinner. The note goes to Hancock. Hancock realizes, oh my, he's called my bluff. I may be the most popular man in Boston and Massachusetts, but there I am nothing compared to George Washington. And so he sends back a hurried note saying, I will be risking all but death, but I have made a mistake and not first going to you. I will come over. So quite dramatically, he is carried over to Washington's quarters by two servants, his legs wrapped in red flannel, and says, you know, it's killing me, but here I am. And Washington says, I will now come to dinner if you want to invite me. And so because of that confrontation, which was widely commented on, people realized, a governor is no longer the most powerful person in America. It is the president of the United States. And we take it for granted today, but that's all only because Washington refused Hancock's dinner invitation.
The celebration of Washington in Boston competes with anything any other city could do. I have here 24,000 crowd. Is that possible, Nat?
Yeah, it is. It is right. And it's, you know, people were crowded on the roofs of the houses and the streets everywhere. I mean, it was just chock-a-block full of people. And it was a small town back then, very contained. And they were all there to see George Washington.
One observer, and I believe he was an artist, looked upon Washington and saw a pale, almost cadaverous man. Do we know, is that the illnesses that he'd left behind, or is he eating improperly now? What do we believe he actually looked like as opposed to the rosy-cheeked portraits that we see?
Yeah, I think it was actually a quite realistic, view of Washington at that point. He had almost died a couple of months before with that carbuncle operation. And people remarked on how thin he was. And then while in Boston, he came down with what became known as the Washington flu, because an influenza that was working its way up the coast had reached New York just as Washington was leaving, would follow Washington all the way north and east. And so he had come down with it just the day before, taken a day off, but was now back out, And as he was, this portrait was begun while, based on a sketch the artist had done while Washington was attending a concert that ended up being much briefer than it originally was going to be because many of the musicians were sick. And so Washington was not in good health. And he was at a point, he realized the presidency was not good for him, that it might very well kill him. And yet he felt he had only, the only option he had was to give it everything he had.
Washington was a punctual man. And yes. He departs Boston on October 29th. I'm following Nat's reporting. 8 a.m. And the escort that always showed up, the romantic riders, cavalry supporting him, were late. And I liked him for this, Nat. I mean, it's striking that in an age where the clocks were not synchronized, Washington kept a very careful pattern of always arriving on time and leaving on time.
Well, you know, he had a sense of military precision when it came to time, and he was obsessive. He would buy it. You know, timepieces were very important to him. His secretary, Tobias Lear, when he began as a secretary back in Mount Vernon, was late in two instances. And on the second instance, Lear said it was because his timepiece was not functioning right. And Washington informed him if Lear did not get himself a new watch, Washington would be getting himself a new secretary. He had no patience for having to wait. And so, anyone who had served with Washington in the army knew that he was a punctual man. And so when the cavalry are late, he really did not like having a cavalry giving him an escort because it kicked up dust that he would have to eat in his carriage. So he saw a great opportunity and went for it. The soldiers would catch up to him. And one of them had served with Washington, and Washington would remind him, say that he thought he had known better about his punctuality, having served with Washington during the Revolution.
Washington leaves Boston and on to Portsmouth. Portsmouth and Kittery are the two northernmost parts of the country he travels to. And again, the irony, the paradox of Washington. Who was Ona Judge?
Ona Judge was Martha's enslaved house servant, who would during Washington's second term, once the temporary capital had moved to Philadelphia, who would flee the presidential mansion, get on a ship, and ultimately sail to Portsmouth in search of freedom. She would there marry a sailor and have several children. When they realized that Ona had left, Washington put an ad in the paper, for a runaway slave. Twice he would he would learn that she had ended up in Portsmouth, and he would use the power of his government, the local customs inspector, to interview Ona and try to convince her to come back. He even had thoughts of forcing her back. This is the disturbing paradox of Washington. Washington is someone who would free his enslaved workers upon his death. And yet on the last year of his life, when he was drafting that will, he was pursuing Ona Judge, who was there in Portsmouth. And so, Washington was believed that slavery was evil, that it was inimical to the future of the Union. And yet when it came to his own household, he was unable to see that slavery was something that this was an inhuman act. And so we're left with the paradox of Washington and ultimately the paradox of our country's beginning when it comes to the great sin of slavery.
In reading your work, Nat, I was reminded of how this is a foreshadowing of what will happen in the 19th century. Custis Lee, Washi, Custis Lee Park, the fact that Washi, the favored grandchild, developed a character that is contemptible towards human beings, and that while she was in the household where this division was in front of him all the time, Washington, the hero who wanted to free, who wanted to be an abolitionist, and the dour slaves, Ona Judge was a dour slave that Washington couldn't he couldn't reject his own heritage.
Right. I mean, and so what, I mean, one of the things about Washington, this is, Washington was someone who became a slave owner at age 11 when his father died, and he inherited several enslaved workers. And yet by the other side of the revolution, he's with the help, I think, of Lafayette, the great abolitionist French general, Washington would see the evil of slavery. And yet Washington was a Southerner whose wife, Martha's dead husband's estate was contained half the slaves at Mount Vernon, and Washington had no legal recourse to free them. And so it's complicated. Washington, you know, we can criticize Washington today for not having the strength of character to insist upon what his higher ideals realized was the right thing. But I think all of us today are guilty of not measuring up to what we know we should be doing. And Washington failed us in this instance, but he was a product of a time, a different time, and I don't think it negates helping in forming the Union, the same principle that would lead Abraham Lincoln to issuing the Emancipation Proclamation.
And Nat, Robert E. Lee married into that family.
Yeah,
and Lee Mansion sits there over the gravestones of people who died to free the slaves, and Washington's inability to overcome it cursed the next generation because of Washington.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and it's so personal. I mean, here's Washington's adopted grandson who was raised as his son, you know, inherits this huge pile of money from his dead grandfather, and builds this huge, you know, the building that now stands on the hill overlooking the military cemetery at Arlington. And his daughter marries Robert E. Lee.
Right.
And it's Robert E. Lee in that building will, after being offered to lead the Union Army by Abraham Lincoln, will make the decision not to do that. And I mean, this is just two generations from George Washington, and who works with all his might to create the Union. Two generations later, there is Robert E. Lee thinking he is embracing all the traditions of George Washington, deciding to side against the Union. I personally think Washington's heart would have broken if he had been magically transported into that time. Because for him, at one point, Jefferson records Washington saying during a cabinet meeting that if slavery should ever divide this country, I will go with the northern part. He said that. And, that is a remarkable statement coming from a Virginian.
The book is Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. Nathaniel Philbrick is the author. We're headed to Spies on Long Island. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.